Listen, we have Sam Smink from WFSB in studio. Now, Sam, I didn't know until I sat next to you when I was filling in at WFSB, and I'm in the investigator pod, and you guys are always humming along, and you won the award for best reporter in Connecticut. That's pretty cool.
That was pretty cool, and I think if anybody watched my acceptance speech, it was kind of came as a shock, but it was nice. You work hard, and it's really nice to sometimes see that recognition.
Now, as an investigative reporter, and again, it's really difficult to do. Even the networks have trouble doing it, right? Even the national people. And a lot of times in some markets, I know when I was at NBC 10 in Boston, Ryan Kaff does a nice job, but a lot of it ends up being consumer focused, right? But to do your job well, you need to be able to take yourself out of the day-to-day news grind. And if you have a big story, they're like, oh, we want you to do this. How hard is it to actually get investigative work done?
Well, we're lucky at Channel 3 because they've made a commitment to investigative reporting, and our parent company really likes investigative reporting. So when we're working on really important things that we know are going to take a while, we'll have conversations with the managers and say, I kind of got to be out of the mix today unless it's big enough where you want me to hop on air. So we get a lot of time to really sit there and develop what we need to do, because I don't think people realize just how much can go into an investigative report. Sometimes, we're only on air for 3 minutes and 30 seconds with that report, but that took days and weeks. And, I tell a lot of people getting into investigative journalism in the first place, they say, but what if I'm not turning something that day? And I go, you might spend a whole day reading pages and pages of data and research, and maybe to find out it's not a story, but you still did your job because
are you secure enough in what you're doing to, if you hit a dead end, to be like, listen, it's a dead end, we got to move on to something else?
Yeah, I wasn't in the beginning. I've been doing journalism. I've been a reporter for about 13 years. I've been an investigative journalist for about 11 years. In the beginning, you kind of wanted to make things work. And then it was just having the right people around me, executive producers and managers that were just like, I don't think that that's there, what you think that is.
We're talking with Sam Smink from WFSB. So, you've worked in, you went to Penn State. You're from Pennsylvania. And so you know the news market there, even if you necessarily didn't work in it professionally. You were in Florida, you were in Boston, now here in Connecticut. The first question is, when did you make that transition from either straight reporting or anchoring into investigative, and why'd you do it?
When I was in Fort Myers, I was about 8 months in, and that was only about 2.5 years into my career, and it was my bosses that actually came to me. The investigative reporter who was there was actually going to Atlanta, and they said, are you interested in this? And I go, well, why me? And they said, well, you're always coming in day after day after you're turning your day of story and saying, I think we should pursue this further. I want to know why this happened. I want to know how often this happened. And I laughed and kind of said, well, isn't that what I'm supposed to be doing as a journalist? And they go, no, you'd be surprised. Because a lot of the times with the general assignment, you do that for the day, you cover that fire.
Right.
It's done. But
some reporters don't care about the content so much. Sometimes they just want to look good on TV and have it be clean.
Well, I think that's much more... People think that's more common than it is. But yes, there can be some cases. But it's more just about, sometimes you just think you cover that fire for that day and that's it. But then, you talk to people, and I'm talking to a source and he's like, yeah, that fire's happened there the last couple days, or, fire that owner of that building. There's been a couple weird fires. And I've always just had more questions, and they were like, that's what makes you a good investigator. And so in the beginning, I was the same way. I was like, yeah, but I'm not turning every day, so it means I'm not doing something every day. And they were like, no, that's a stupid way to look at it. And so then I just fell in love with it. And now I can't imagine going back to the daily grind. I love digging into why things are happening and taking that time to have those conversations with people.
Yeah, as much as I enjoy anchoring, the real work now and the way contemporary TV broadcast media is, the real good work being done when it's done is on the reporting side, obviously. So if you really want a story and you want to tell a story or do some good work, that's where it's done. We're talking with Sam Smink from WFSB. I'm curious, Florida, Boston, Connecticut. Florida is just kind of, I feel like it's just wild. I don't know. I don't know.
We always laugh that we think Florida is the best like reporter workshop, so to speak. Like once you go to, if you can handle working in Florida, you can handle working everywhere because it's just insane. There was always something happening. And I know some people are like, Florida, what do you mean? And it's like, I was courts and crimes in Fort Myers and I had something every day. And it's just wild stuff. And there's always something big happening somewhere else that's only 2 hours outside of Fort Myers or 2 hours outside of West Palm where I also worked. It's so fast moving that I feel like it really does give you that experience of how to move quickly. Like I was, when I started in Fort Myers, I was what you call an MMJ, a multimedia journalist.
So you shot and edited
edited, did my own stuff. And it was the first time I'd been in a place that had a 4 o'clock, a 5 o'clock, a 6 o'clock. I was expected to turn a story for 4, 5, and 6.
A different one.
Sometimes, usually on the same subject, but they wanted you to switch around the writing. I mean, it couldn't be the exact same story. And so that taught me how to be fast, but also still make sure I'm right. And I think it was a really good boot camp was the word I was looking for. A really good boot camp. Just the insanity. And you're constantly doing live shots, which in my first market was in small Elmira in upstate New York. Well, they call it upstate New York. We didn't even have a live truck. So, I mean, I didn't do live shots. So now I'm doing live shots 3 times, 4 times, 5 times a day.
So you got better quick. You know, I'm going to ask you a little bit more about Connecticut. And we also want to talk about your 5-part series on housing that starts tonight on WFSB. We're here talking with Sam Smink from WFSB. You know, like I worked in TV for so many years. And so I love talking about the business and every market's different. And I haven't had necessarily on the local level, the diversity. I did local in Connecticut and Boston. That's it. I'm curious, like, obviously, Florida, you said, was nuts, and you were in Boston, which is just a much bigger city.
Yeah.
But you like it here.
I really like it here.
So why?
What I like about here is that you really get time to dig into what is affecting everyone. Like, Florida's just such a modgepodge of people coming from all walks of life and all places across the U.S., and there's a little bit of they don't have the love for the state as much as you would think. So, yeah, they care about some local issues. But when you're in Connecticut, a majority of people from here grew up here, born and raised here. And they really, truly care about making the state as a whole better. And it's really interesting being able to cover a whole state, minus Fairfield County. We technically don't really go out there.
We don't pay a lot of attention to it.
Well, they're New York City's market, so we kind of don't do it unless it's really big. But it's really interesting getting to meet people that were born and raised here and how much they really want to make this city better. And I feel like you can hone in a little bit more on what everybody seems to care about, whereas in Florida, you just had so many people. You have people from the South. You have people from the Northeast. Right. They have different personalities. There's different things that they care about.
You know, and housing is a really good example. I mean, outside of maybe immigration, affordability was a massive issue. And we cover a lot of politics here on Brian and Company. And in Connecticut, especially, it's about affordability. I mean, people, first-time homebuyers, people can't afford to buy a home. And then if you're in a middle income or lower income, you have no shot. And, you know, the pandemic was great if you own a home because the values went way up and you have a lot more equity. But and they can't get supply up enough. So, you know, you're doing a 5-part series. I'm curious about how you're breaking it into, like, what are the 5 parts?
Well, tonight we're starting with the economics of buying a home right now, what we're seeing. Like, we know the national economics play into it with interest rates, mortgage rates, how hard it is to get quality property insurance and affordable property insurance. But then throughout the week, we dig into what is affecting Connecticut specifically. And yes, while interest rates intensify the problem, the affordability problem in Connecticut comes down to supply, a lack of supply. You see studies from all across the state. The numbers go all over the place, but safe to say around 100,000 units of housing are needed just for low income and middle income, which is a lot of people say we didn't start noticing this till middle income was being affected. And we've talked to some advocates that say Connecticut has kind of done this to themselves over the years because they've kind of been ignoring that the problem would sneak up on them. And then obviously COVID just exacerbated all the problems. And we look at the lack of construction. Like, we're averaging about 4,000 to 5,000 new construction permits a year. In 2010, that was 20,000 new construction permits. And yeah, we know the cost of construction materials plays into it, but it's also because of a lot of local zoning restrictions. And the legislature has tried to make moves over the years. They successfully in 2021 said that zoning boards could no longer deny a project based on the character of their town. They couldn't just deny it because they said, we don't want to mess with the character of our town. But there's other things that we're still doing according to
some. But there's
a
ton of like not in my backyard stuff. Like,
yes, that's a big issue. And a lot of it, advocates say, comes down to educating the public, because a lot of the times it's not even that the zoning commission, the people on the zoning boards are opposed to it. It's that the citizens of the town are opposed to it. And they want people to understand just really what successful affordable housing can look like. Like, we have some towns that still like require at least 5 acres for a home to be built. And that's 3.5 football fields. The most towns require 1.5 acres. That's more than a football field. And we talk to advocates that show us some of these homes they've built in New Haven that still are great two-family homes that can fit on an acre, and it looks great.
Well, you bring up a really interesting part of the conversation. We're talking with Sam Smink from WFSB Channel 3. She has a 5-part series on housing here in Connecticut. It starts tonight and runs all week. And just really quick before I get to my point, is the main story going to run in the 6 or the 11? Or the
It's going to run in the 5 o'clock. We're going to have each story for the week run in the 5 o'clock.
Okay. And, you know, for me, everything that's coming online is an apartment building. And it's great because it adds units and gets people in. But the way to create communities is to have, like, houses. But it's not profitable to build houses in Connecticut. And the land's expensive. Obviously, construction's expensive. And the margins are just better in apartment buildings. And I don't know how that's going to change.
So a lot of advocates say it could start by just if towns just start allowing more multifamily housing in terms of like duplexes, triplexes, cottages to help build.
Or like row houses.
Or row houses, that sort of thing. They haven't really talked about row houses specifically in Connecticut. I think sometimes that gets a negative connotation. But growing up in Northeast Philadelphia, we had row homes all the time. And so they talk about that smaller scale, which again doesn't add units immediately, but still can kind of keep what some of these towns are looking at. But there's, you know, the town of Woodbridge, Open Communities Alliance, which is a civil rights organization, they're suing the town of Woodbridge because they say only 0.2% of land is zoned for anything more than a single family home. And they say that just adds so many problems. And all they're asking for are simple changes along the lines just to add 2 family homes, 3 family homes. And they said they're just getting pushback for that sort of stuff.
It feels like in Hartford especially, there's a lot that's coming online. We talked to people in Bristol. But in your reporting, do you feel like there's an understanding that it needs to change? Because the town handles their business and the state can only do so much, right? I mean, do you think that this problem is going to persist moving forward, or is there enough collective we get it that it might change?
I think there's a collective we get it. I think the collective we get it is moving slower than people would like. And I think we could see in this upcoming session more movement towards providing those incentives and providing a timetable that's a little quicker. Because we talked with the Connecticut Council of Small Towns, and they say there are already conversations about how they can maybe simplify the permit process to get more housing built quicker. So they're aware of the issue. I think that what happens is a lot of the times these bills come forward and they mix both housing issues and apartment issues. There's some renter issues thrown in with housing issues. And then, you know, you see it with all bills. If you throw too much in, then everybody doesn't want that bill to pass. But we've talked with several people that were like, we just have bills that specifically say this is the problem we want to tackle. This is how we should do it. It's much easier to go back and forth rather than mixing all of these different things together. Because we've seen in the past, you know, we talked with Representative Joe Zullo, and he said, you know, we've seen some renters issues hidden in these housing bills. And he's like, I would love to talk about these renters issues, but they don't really go along with what we're trying to do with the housing zoning issues. He's like, so then all of a sudden we're opposed to the bill, but we're not really. And it's just the confusion that we see.
And my head hurts right now just listening to that. I mean, it's
but we see it on the federal level too. Like, how many times have they tried to throw something into a bill and then that bill gets denied when it could actually help somebody because something else is in there that they're trying to just like
And rarely does new legislation help streamline. It just adds to what's already complicated. You know, we only have a couple of seconds left here with Sam Smink from WFSB. So there are five parts. And just to repeat it, can you break down? And tonight's going to be on?
Tonight's kind of the economics of buying a new home and what are we looking at. And we're also talking about some programs that can help you with down payment and closing costs. And then tomorrow we're looking into the lack of supply and what's led us to that. Then on Wednesday, we're looking into the lack of construction and the zoning, restrictive zoning. And then Thursday, we're talking about 830G, which is a very controversial state process that involves if developers get a project denied, they can then appeal to the state. They can appeal to the courts to get it. It's controversy because some local zoning commissions feel that like you can just call Project 830G and get whatever you want.
Right.
We're diving into that. And on Friday, we're diving into all the solutions that we've learned from all of the people that we've talked to over the week.
And again, it's in the 5 o'clock hour on WFSB Channel 3. Sam, it's great to have you in. It's really
great. This is so much fun. I hope I'm invited back. I'm calling him out right here, so he has to.
And she liked Tommy and her sandwich. So she's in the club. Sam Smink from WFSB. Again, in the 5 o'clock hour, Monday through Friday on Connecticut and housing.